Hi, I'm Mitchell Rushlow. I'm an architect searching the world to learn more about the buildings and environments humans have created from the modern era all the way back to prehistory. I believe that our buildings reflect the culture and context of the people who built them and can reveal fundamental insights about ourselves. Using architecture as our lens, we can learn more about who we are and where we come from. With this knowledge, we can build environments for our future that will facilitate our thriving and vitality. Today, I had the privilege of speaking with Peter Davenport. Peter was a professional archaeologist for 46 years, 25 of those as a senior archaeologist at Bath Archaeological Trust. Since 1980, he's been involved in all of the excavations carried out in the Roman baths and a large majority of the excavations in the city of Bath. He's a trustee on the Roman Baths Foundation, and he's the author of Roman Bath, A New History and Archaeology of Aquasulis. Today, Peter and I spoke about the architecture of the Roman baths, the chronology of construction, technologies, and the engineering, and also the bath's wider impact on the ancient community. Peter gave us firsthand insight into his experiences and the artifacts that were uncovered while excavating at the baths. The depth and richness of his knowledge were astonishing and helped me to obtain a much clearer picture of the life of the building and the people who used it. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today. I want to start off and just ask you, can you tell us a little bit about your involvement in the baths, the Roman baths, and in the city of Bath?
Right. Well, I became a professional archaeologist in the 1970s, having not studied archaeology at the beginning, but I did go back to university and studied it. And after a few years in the field, I was fortunate enough to be offered the job of running an excavation in Bath, in the Roman baths, a new area that was being opened up. That was three seasons, and when I started, I thought that was going to be the work. I was going to be paid off after 3 years and find something else to do. I ended up staying for 25 years, running excavations in Bath and around the Roman baths, but also further afield. I worked for a company called Bath, a not-for-profit called Bath Archaeological Trust, which closed in 2005 for various reasons, and I went off to work for other companies. I retired in 2019 from full-time work. But during that time, I was still involved in several projects at the Roman baths because I had this experience and expertise about the archaeology of the baths.
So you were on site. Your hands were touching these things. You were observing these things nearly every day. I mean, you had
to... Oh, yeah. I mean, latterly, as a lot of people, I was kicked upstairs to management, as it were. But I still visited sites almost every day when they were running, was involved in decisions about how we're going to do the work and so on. I always enjoyed digging, and I never completely left it alone, though I had a very good staff that from the last few years I was there who were actually on site every day. I've continued to retain an interest in the Roman baths. I'm now a trustee of the Roman Baths Foundation, which is a charity which is designed to try to raise money and funds for work in the museum that, for various reasons, the local city council, who can't access certain grants and funds, might want to carry out. So educational work in the Roman Baths Museum for schools and that sort of thing. So I'm still very much involved in the museum, and the museum is essentially the museum of the Roman Baths. So it does spread out into Bath archaeology a little bit as well.
And can you give us a bit of a brief introduction to the Roman Baths and some historical context for it?
Right. Bath is in the southwest of England, and although it's about 150 miles away from the Roman invasion point, which was in 43 AD, the locals seem to have been fairly friendly to the Romans. They got here very quickly. There were no battles. So the Romans kind of settled around this area. The army were here first, and it's probably the army that set up the baths after about 20, 30 years of the conquest and Britain being rather more settled. And we actually know that the baths and the associated temple to the goddess Sulis Minerva was underway. They were building it in the 60s AD. That's less than 20 years after, well, about 20 years after the invasion. So you've got the Romans invading the island of Britain, which was in those days divided up into tribes. It wasn't one country. The locals were threatened by their neighbours, and that's why they were happy to have the Romans here, because they were protecting them. And this area has always been... the sort of west of London, has been in the Roman period. It got Romanized very quickly, the Roman villas, Roman towns, Roman material and pottery and coins and all the rest of it. So it was an area that, if you like, welcomed the Roman invasion in a way. The baths were then going and were being used probably by the army at first in the sort of 60s, 70s, 80s AD. And then over the next 250 years or more, which is when the Romans were here, the town grew up around the baths. The baths were continually modified, extended and altered, modernized, if you like. And they were in use right up until, well, within a decade or two, probably, of the end of the Roman Empire in the West, which is in Britain about 410 AD.
Fantastic. So this is a natural spring. The Romans came in. They found a way to, let's say, optimize or use the natural geological feature, built a bath complex around it, which was really, it seems to be the kind of impetus for building the town around, or something that the town was built around as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Romans were here as much because it was a strategic position. There's a river crossing, the road junctions, there's a valley through the hills between sort of slightly to the east, slightly to the west, and to the gateway to Wales in the west. But yeah, once they were here and realized what was going on, they discovered the hot springs, obviously, which bubble up. We know from investigations and comparisons elsewhere, it would have been just, there were three springs very close together in the center of what's now modern Bath. And the Romans basically got the plumbing in. They built drains and pools to hold the water so they could feed it into the baths, built the baths around all the hydraulics that they'd organized on all three sites. That's the King's Bath is the one which the main Roman baths were built around. There are two other smaller springs just 50 meters away. They had their own little establishments. And the hot springs are the only hot springs in Britain. That's why they're unusual in the island. And the Romans were used to hot springs in Italy and in southern Germany and parts of France, where they're far more common. And so they knew what to do. They saw this hot water. Oh, great. You know, here we are. We can do this. Then people started to come to it from all across Britain, all across northern Europe. In fact, we know from inscriptions they left behind and tombstones and so on. And people came to service the visitors. And we know that there was a big monumental center. There were temples and baths and theaters, subsidiary buildings, all in that central area. And then the main street out of town to the north, which is actually the road to London, became a kind of a suburb with lots of houses and shops and workshops along it. Again, as for people, that was the main route that people would have entered that central area. So it would have been the words we often use is economic engine. The baths, the hot springs with the economic engine behind the growth of the city.
It's interesting to think that the Romans took a building typology that they were very familiar with in Rome. They found this location and they said, wow, this is amazing. We don't have to heat the water here. The water's already heated for us. We can save a massive amount of money, expense, and labor and just optimize this natural feature.
That's true. But the other point you need to sort of realize is just how much labor and effort it took to build the baths. There was no building, no stone building tradition in Britain at the time. There were a few dry stone walls and some of the round houses that the locals lived in had low dry stone walls. But to build what they built, they had to find timber for scaffolding and roofs. They had to find stone. Fortunately, Bath is blessed with very high quality building stone in the immediate vicinity. They had to find sand and lime to make mortar, and they had to get a workforce. Was not an unusual thing for the Roman army to do. They probably were in charge of everything. The Roman army did have an engineering corps, if you like, and they would have organized that, but it took pretty major organization and effort to do that, and money. And we don't really know who paid for it, though we kind of assume it was probably the governor of the new province in the first century, because there wouldn't have been any local people with that kind of aspiration, let alone money, even though some of the locals did make money out of the Romans by providing services, and some had land and houses nearby. But you're right. I mean, it was an amazing opportunity, but they really took it on.
So they had to build an ecosystem, a construction industry. They had to start
from
ground up build the pits, I can just imagine, the upfront work, which also, I think, probably shows their commitment to the area as well. I mean, this was not something they were going to move into move out of. They were committed.
That's right. Bath's lucky in Roman building terms. There's a lot of local resources around. About 15 miles to the south, there are lead mines, and they use a lot of lead to line the baths and probably to use in the roof, though we can't be sure about that, certainly for gutters and things like that. And the Roman army took over those, exploited and used those lead mines almost immediately. I mean, within 10, 15 years of the conquest, the Roman army were down around that area, built themselves a little fort and a small settlement for workers, and they were exploiting the lead very soon. And of course, lead, we forget, was for the Romans actually a source of silver. Lead always has a small amount of silver in it. And lead in to the Romans was a byproduct of silver making, a big byproduct, because you made much, much more lead out of the ore than you did silver. But the silver was valuable. It was a government monopoly.
Peter, what drew you initially to the Bass? Was there something that piqued your interest, or what was it that drew you to it?
You know, I could be absolutely honest and say that at that point in my career, I was very pleased to be offered a job. But nonetheless, I never trained as a Romanist. I trained as a prehistorian. But I also had a strong interest in historic building, ancient buildings, modern buildings, anything to do with architecture, really, as a sort of a study, not creatively. And the Roman baths is not just the Roman baths. It's also a real palimpsest of Roman remains, medieval remains, 18th and 19th century buildings, which straddle the remains. And so actually, that fascinates me, that understanding how that all worked and worked together as a unit. But having got here, I mean, Bath is a wonderful place to work. It's a beautiful city. I feel privileged to have spent so much of my career here, and I still live just outside the city. The archaeology was really interesting, informative. So much of the Roman baths was excavated in the late 19th century, when techniques were not what we would like to think of now as being adequate. And there are lots of questions which we could answer with modern excavation, which you just weren't asked at the time. But if you look really, really hard at certain areas and parts and think again about the Roman baths, we keep discovering new sort of answers to questions we had, or new questions to answers we don't have. It's a continuing study. It's really fascinating and interesting in that way.
Yeah, I love how you mentioned that it's not just a Roman ruin. It has traces of each kind of period in history, all the way back from prehistory to Romans leading up. And in that way, it's kind of a book. It allows you to unfold living history of the area. Just amazing.
Yeah. Having made that point, it's true that another fascination, another aspect, is when you're working in one place for a long time, you really get to feel that you're getting to understand the history of that place. It's not just going to a site and digging it and publishing it and going away and doing something else, or being a researcher in some specific aspect of prehistoric or Roman or medieval archaeology, but you're actually pulling together the story of a place. Now, I can plug a book and say that I recently published a book called Roman Bath, which was a history and archaeology of Roman Bath, what we think we know now in 2021 is when it was published. And so putting that together was really only possible because of the of my involvement and the time I spent in Bath.
Yeah, and I think that's what initially drew me to you, is I obviously read your book, but then read your biography and saw that you had been involved in the site. So when seeing that, I'm thinking, okay, this is information coming directly from the source in a way. Your hands had been touching these things, rather than and you just having researched multiple books and then kind of compiled them into a research paper or something. This is direct involvement, which I think is you know, pure information, or what is the most pure source of information you can possibly get there.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll move on and ask, can you tell us a little bit about the natural geological process that supplies the water for the baths?
Right. Bath, Aquae Sullis to the Romans, sits in a valley, quite a narrow valley, and much of the geology around it is, well, it's limestone on the hills either side, with various complications and faults and problems with the geology. It's very unstable in a long-term sense. It's not about to fall on anybody. It's surrounded by a ring, quite some distance away, like 10, 12, 15 miles, of limestone rocks, hills. And what seems to be the case is that rain falling on those limestone hills soaks through the porous limestone down to a solid strata several hundred feet down below the ground, flows in the porous limestone above the non-porous layer. Then it finds a fault, which happens to be where Bath is now, a fault leading up to the surface, a crack in the stonework. And the pressure of all the rock on top forces the water up through that crevice, through that crack, or those small series of cracks and crevices. And then it pops up in the middle of Bath, where the river Avon, which is the river that runs through the central Bath in the bottom of the valley, seems about the end of the last ice age, maybe 10,000 years ago, to have scoured away, what as a river flowing through, the last little bits, remaining bits of rock and stone that were stopping that water popping up. And this water just threw up into the valley bottom, and then away into the river, where it was just wasted, as it were, before humans came along. So we're looking at rainwater that fell on those hills probably about 5 to 10,000 years ago. We can date it very roughly, and then comes up in the springs in Bath. So when you drink that water or you bathe in it in the new private baths, you can be drinking or bathing in water that's around at least 5,000 years old. It's the pressure of the rocks above that water that keeps it hot. If you were just to jump straight into the main spring where it comes up at full temperature, you jump out again. It's very hot. But it cools down quite quickly. The Romans were quite clever at that. They, in the reservoir that they built around the main spring, the King's Bath, they let the water flow through gravity quite slowly into the Great Roman Swimming Bath, and then into two other baths further on, cooling as it went. And so the Great Swimming Bath, if you go in at one end where the hot water comes in, it's pretty warm, pretty hot, but bearable because it's cooled slightly as it's run through the channels. Go to the other end and it's lukewarm, you know, so you can choose which temperature you like.
Yeah, so it's a geological U-shaped stratum of limestone, falls roughly, I think you mentioned, in Mendips, and gets geothermally heated at the base of it, pressurized, comes back up, and then, you know, discharges at the
Yeah, because before the Romans came, we do have information now from excavation and various environmental studies that it was probably, these three springs came up in three pools, which formed in the valley bottom, comes up about 10, 15 feet above the actual river level. So it's up to one side, and then it flows down. And you can imagine turning up before the Romans were here, where it's just these three hot steaming pools with all sorts of weird colours because there's iron in it, and the iron salts come out and make an orange colour on the rocks and some of the plants and lichen that grows. Still some of that visible there. But we know from various studies of ancient seeds that survived that the area was what they call an alder car, slightly swampy, wooded area. And so when the Romans came along, they then had to deal not just with containing and channeling the water, but they also had to work through this boggy area, and they probably did quite a lot of digging and clearing away and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So they had to control it. Now with it was the Dibuni tribe that was there before the Romans. Is that
That's right? The British Isles were divided up into tribal groups, which were independent little countries, if you like, and they were often fighting each other. At the time of the Roman conquest, there were quite powerful tribes to the east of England around London. London wasn't there then, but in that area. And they were sort of expanding westwards and southwards. They were taking over some of the smaller or less powerful tribes, of whom we think the Dibuni, about 100 miles west of London, their area is, were being pressured by these powerful tribes to the east. And also a more bellicose tribe to the south called the Durotriges, who live in modern-day Dorset down towards the coast, but bordered on the southern side of the Dibuni. That's why we think the Dibuni were happy for the Romans to come along, because they offered protection against these other tribes that were pressing in. And we do have a reference in a Roman history to a tribe called the Boduni, which we think is a typo for Dibuni, hurrying along to visit to meet the Roman army long before they'd actually reached this part of the country to offer their submission. So that gives us a clue.
Was there a bit of evidence or work that had gone on from the Dibuni tribe where they built a bit of an outcropping or a little wall near the spring?
That's right. Thanks for reminding me. In these muddy pools, which are very difficult to approach because of the mud and slush around them, and probably they were quite scary. I mean, they would have been steaming and these bright colours and rather strange, probably stunted car or alders of sort of small bushy trees around it. And it would have had this aura of religion and superstition, because we know there was a god or goddess called Sulis that they worshipped and the Romans took over and conflated with their god, goddess Minerva. But what they seem to have done, the Dibunic people, is built on the south side of the main muddy pool, which became the King's Bath, a causeway of stones and gravel, which they'd obviously bucketed and barrowed in. We don't know how far it went because we only have the end of it. We excavated part of it in the King's Bath itself, an artificial gravel causeway, which had sort of a certain amount of timber riveting pushed in around the edge to hold it in place. And it was actually, interestingly, above that Iron Age causeway, where we imagine the pre-Roman people came along to make their offerings into the spring. And we do have pre-Roman coins, though we can't be sure when they were put in. Pre-Roman coins were found there. But immediately above that causeway was where the Romans built their archway and platform from which they threw their objects in. So they probably, you know, realized that this was kind of a holy place where you approach the god or goddess. And when they built their baths, in the very first phase in the late first century, they built the access over the Iron Age causeway.
The Dibuni were using it for some spiritual purposes. The Romans came in, observed it, attempted to kind of start to control the natural feature by building some drains, and then I believe a reservoir, right? Can you tell us a little bit about the reservoir?
Yeah, the reservoir, which basically around the spring, about 25, 30 feet diameter, the Romans built a great big stone wall made of huge blocks of local Bath stone, just quickly enclosed the central part of the spring. Before they did that, they dug a drain, which became one of the main drains, at a very low level, to drain the water away temporarily while they built this wall. The foundations of this wall were oak piles about 9 inches in diameter driven into the ground around the spring, because that's a very unstable position. You've got this water bubbling up and swirling around. You need to stabilize the ground. And so they did, with hundreds of oak piles driven into the ground, on which they then built the wall. Sounds odd to us these days, but oak piles and other timbers that are even better at standing up to rot in the water are a very common building practice. The whole of Venice, for example, is built on timber piles. So it's a very substantial thing. And that stone wall, it was an irregular polygon, sort of 7 or 8 sides, about 20 inches thick and about 3 meters high. When it was complete, they built a sluice at a higher level than the original drain, so they could control the level of the water into the drain, which they then formally adopted and built out better. And then it was an open-air pool. The water rose up again within this reservoir. And it rose to a level pre-planned by the Roman engineers, so that the water flowed through a channel, just like a bath overflow, but into the great swimming bath, which they built just to the east of the King's Bath itself. So the King's Bath was never in Roman times used for bathing. It was the source of the water for the baths, and it was the place where they felt the goddess dwelt when she was there. That was where you made your offerings, which we found in excavation many years later. And we know from an inscription that the Romans called it the Fons Sulis, the spring of Sulis, the goddess Sulis, and say that there was no bathing took place in there. The bathing took place in the purpose-built baths, which were built alongside the spring and fed from it.
Interesting. This is incredible that in the reservoir, it had the sluice on top, the drain below. The drain was closed, allowed the sluice to open and then channel water into the bath. Is that right?
I mean, Roman hydrology was basically about gravity feed. They could do siphoning. They could make water go uphill if they started higher up and then down and up again. But they didn't really have pumps. They did have pumps. They could raise water to about 20 or 30 feet, atmospheric pumps. But that was sort of small-scale stuff. Like to feed a rich house upstairs, you might have a pump to take the water up to the tank. Some poor slave would pump away for several hours to fill the tank, you know, from wherever the supply was. But they couldn't do large-scale movement of water except through gravity. And so basically it was getting the water to a level where you could run it from. Then you had sluices in various places to control the flow. So if you had too much water, you could drain it off. If you had not enough, you could close up the sluice, or the sluices, because there are several. The main sluice, two particular sluices were recovered during excavations in the 19th century. They're in the museum now. They're made of bronze. They're quite substantial metal framework, just like a modern gate sluice. You know, it's a framework into which you drop the gate itself into grooves in the framework. And then you simply lift it up to let the water out, or let it down again, or sort of lift it up a certain amount to let a certain amount of water out. And there are 3 or 4 places where that's the case.
So they're building the sluice. That technology just seems incredible for them to implement at that time. But I think you had mentioned earlier that was technology already being used in Rome. Yeah. You know, they had
in all sorts of I mean, the Greeks and Romans had baths, but the Greeks' baths were pretty much individual, you know, tubs that you went and had sat in. The Romans invented, you know, the sauna, the Turkish bath, the swimming, you know, the swimming hot plunge, cold plunge, all that kind of stuff. And they were building baths in the first century BC, so 100 and more years before they came into Britain. They were building the first of the grand, really highly organized, architecturally grand buildings around about the time they were building this one in Bath. The one at Bath does reflect the technology and the design of these somewhat earlier baths. People who visited Rome have visited the huge baths of Caracalla or Diocletian or even Titus. And they are huge, amazing, astonishing structures, very organized, very symmetrical, very architectural. The ones in the first century were slightly less grand. They were pretty big structures. I mean, the one in Bath we'll talk about in a moment was a very substantial masonry structure with originally a huge timber roof, then later on stone and concrete vaulting. These weren't small, tucked away private baths. These were public baths, big buildings. But the Roman baths at Bath were, in their beginnings, were very similar to the beginnings of substantial Roman baths in the center of the empire.
Can you tell us a little bit about more about what the most advanced or final phase of the bath complex would have looked like? I mean, I know it went through several phases, grew steadily, there were add-ons, but what would the most kind of developed form look like?
Yeah, if you visit a museum, you'll see a rather grand, rather wonderful model of what we think the baths looked like in the early 4th century, which is when it reached its height. The whole complex is centered on the hot spring, which by that period had the pond I described, had been enclosed in a huge rectangular building made of brick and concrete and stone, with a brick and concrete vault, a barrel vault, a half-cylinder vault over the... So the whole thing was enclosed. Originally, as I said, it was open air. By the second century and then onwards, they enclosed it in this pretty grand building. On one side of the building, on the north side, was a courtyard, which was a courtyard of the Temple of Sulis Minerva. And in there was an open air courtyard. And off to the west end was the Temple of Sulis Minerva, a rather grand, very Roman looking building. The temple, which I haven't mentioned, but was a temple to the goddess, was very Roman. It wouldn't have been out of place in Rome or in the center of the empire. And it was built certainly by the 70s AD, very early for such a substantially Roman building, a Roman looking building, stone columns, carved pediment, the keller, the central, the inside room, which people didn't go into, but it was where the goddess's statue was. We don't know much about that goddess's statue, except we do have her head, a rather wonderful gilded bronze head of Sulis Minerva, which would have sat atop her statue in the temple. Only the priest and a few important people would have ever gone into there to make sacrifices and communicate with the goddess and bring back anything they thought she'd said to them. Hoi polloi were in the courtyard and making offerings at the altar and walking across through a doorway to make offerings into the spring itself. On the other side of the spring, on the south side, there was the centre of the complex was the Roman swimming bath, the Great Bath, which is about 80 feet long and about 25 feet wide, still lead-lined, 5 feet deep, and still filled with spring water from the spring fed by the Roman drains. And that building, originally timber-roofed by the 4th century, had a very impressive, very grand, very tall brick and concrete vault spanning across the baths. And there were walkways around the baths with piers and archways separating them from the actual pool itself. There was cold water piped in as well. So if you were in the hot swimming pool, you could swim to the side and there were fountains where cold water came out. And we have some of the pipe work and so on for that supply. At each end of the great swimming pool were two completely separate Roman baths of the kind that you would find where there wasn't a hot spring. At the west end, there were the west baths, which were the original baths built to complement the spring and the hot water in the first century, which continued to be expanded and altered. And by the 4th century, had hot and cold rooms, massage rooms, middle heat rooms, dry sauna type rooms, a small swimming pool of its own, changing rooms. The damage that's happened to the building now, over the last 2,000 years, has meant we don't have much information about the interior fitting up. But we do know that there were mosaics because we only have fragments of them. So the floors were covered in probably geometric and or figurative mosaics. We know that all of the rooms at that point had concrete and stone and brick vaults over them. They were all sent underfloor heating. Where there wasn't actually a pool, they were heated. Because the climate in this part of the country is not particularly, it's not like a Mediterranean climate, so you didn't have many unheated rooms. There were a few unheated rooms built, but later on they were given underfloor heating because almost all the rooms were heated. for obvious reasons, if those who visited Britain might know, especially in the winter. Oh, and of course, that those heated rooms required boilers and stoke holes and furnaces, which again, we have evidence for and some remains of. And that would have been where the slaves would have been stoking the fires, which fed the hot air and heated the water. At the other end of the Great Bath, the East Bath, conveniently we now call these the West Baths and the East Baths, but we don't know what the Romans called them. At the East Bath, there is another complete set of baths with its own swimming pool and with heated rooms, the usual cold, warm, hot rooms that you move through, and then you move back and you plunge into cold water to close your pores. Rooms where you could get a massage and get the dirt scraped off you with what they call a strigil, which is a curved metal implement, which you, instead of soap, you covered yourself with olive oil. You sweated like mad in these hot rooms. You came out and either yourself or a slave scraped off the oil and the sweat along with it, all the dirt. And then you had a plunge in the cold water to close your pores. That was their idea of keeping clean. So you've got that East Bath. Was slightly grander because it was built new in the early 4th century, replaced completely what was there before. It was much grander and the rooms much larger. And at the West Bath, that was much more an organic accretion. They just kept adding and changing and extending. Why two baths? Well, we know that various Roman emperors passed laws saying you can't have mixed bathing. So those laws were passed so often that presumably people did do a lot of mixed bathing. But anyway, so we suspect that one of these baths was for men and one was for women. Now, the current museum setup is that the East Baths, these grander rebuilt ones, were the women's baths, and the other one, the West Baths, which were the ones that weren't rebuilt completely, just altered and added to over the years, were the men's baths. If you think about history of men and women in the past, I suspect it might well have been the other way around. The men had the better baths and the women had the smaller one. But having said that, we don't strictly know, we've never quite found the edges of the baths. We don't know how extensive they were. We think we know where certain ends and edges of these buildings were, but because of the limitations of the modern town, we can't just go and dig anywhere. There's all sorts of reasons why you can't. So we think we know where the southern edge is, but we're pretty sure that there's more to the south. We think we know where the northern edge is for various reasons. We don't really know where the east and west edges are. You know, so the buildings, the baths could even be bigger than we think they are. They are very extensive. I mean, they're certainly the biggest thermal baths north of the Alps. There are plenty of similar ones. In southern Germany in particular, there are some very grand spa baths of Roman remains. What's interesting about Bath is that it's the only one with actual water in it and still to some extent used. The Great Bath is still, that's the Great Swimming Bath in the centre of the complex, is still full of hot water fed from the Roman reservoir, and it drains out through the Great Drain, which is the Roman drain down to the river, which is still in use. So you can go there and actually see the water flowing through, and you can imagine what it's like. Some of the other Roman remains in other parts of the empire are more impressive, better preserved, but they don't have any water in them. So that is a plus. That makes it quite interesting.
Yeah. So this is a place where people were not only bathing, doing wellness activities, little gymnasium. It was also a place of socialization. Maybe people were doing business. They were eating. They were drinking. They were.
This is a social community. Part of the reason that the Romans built baths everywhere was because they were their social centres. Mm. Sometimes you go to a bath if you were wealthy enough and had enough leisure every day. You might, and baths were open to everybody, even slaves, if they were the kind of slave who had a certain amount of freedom to travel around, move around, because not all slaves were sort of manacled and tied down. Some were trusted servants, but they just had a particular status that meant they were tied up to certain places. People moved in to sell food and sweetmeats and all the rest of it to the locals. There were barbers working in the baths and to shave you and that kind of thing. There were makeup artists for the ladies and all that kind of stuff. And you just met your equals to do, as you say, to do business. The writer Seneca, the Roman writer who was writing in the mid first century, he's famous for various letters he sent to people. There were real letters he sent, but he also kept them and published them because they were literary things. But one of his famous ones, he complains about the fact that he's living above a Roman baths in a flat, as it were, and he can't do any work because of the noise of the hawkers and the people selling things and calling their wares and the people screaming and the people having their hair plucked from their upper lip instead of being shaved and screaming and that sort of thing. So these are very, very, very busy places. People coming to Bath, to the hot springs, that adds an extra level, because what I've described just now is any bath in any town. But coming to the hot bath, people did come, it would appear, for cures and so on, though we have very little evidence about directly from the Roman period about cures. We have a couple of items which we think might be the equivalent of in a Roman Catholic church. If someone goes to a church and prays to a saint to be cured of some ailment, they'll often hang up a model of the part of their body they want fixed, like an eye or a leg or a breast or something like that. And we have found an ivory breast, an ivory figurine, which is two breasts on, but no head and legs, and a piece of bronze, which appears to be, the specialists say, part of a bronze statue, and it's a breast, thrown into the hot spring. And we think that is a request for help with some kind of illness. The other side of the bath's social aspect, I mentioned the temple. I think you came to the baths as much to come to the temple. There's that trite phrase that cleanliness is next to godliness. Well, actually, in the layout of the baths, godliness in the face of the temple is literally next to and incorporates part of the baths. And I think that visiting the temple and visiting the baths was part of the same deal for those who came to visit, you know, for whatever reason. And we can go back and compare what we know about medieval churches and cathedrals, which were marketplaces as well. People met socially, they conducted business and so on. And every now and again, you get a religious person in that period complaining that the church is being used for non-religious purposes. And that's that. I'm sure that there was that mix in the Roman baths and temple. Roman religion was a bit transactional. You know, you ask the god for a favor, and you promise them you'd do something in return, or the other way around. You say, "I'll do this if you do this for me." And so many of the curses, what we call them, the lead plaques that people have written on and thrown into the spring, are kind of prayers to the goddess to do something for them. In most cases, to find or return stolen goods or punish the person who stole them, and they're a treasure trove of interest.
Can you tell us more about those, Peter? Those are little lead tablets, and how many of those roughly were discovered? I think it was many of them. Yeah,
we excavated in the first phase 130 of them. One was found during excavations in the late 19th century, kind of by chance, really, in the spring. So some limited excavation took place there. And most of them are written in Latin. They're written in about 80 different handwritings, which strongly suggests that the people making the request, the petition to the goddess, wrote them themselves. I mean, if you sort of went to a scribe and said, "This is what I want to say, can you do it for me?" You'd imagine there'd be far fewer handwritings. And our handwriting, Roman handwriting specialists, are quite clear that there are many. To the extent that one curse is also known from about 30 miles away in another Roman site called Uli Temple, where a man of the same name makes a request to the god there, who's Mercury, in handwriting that can be matched up to the tablet he left here, making a request to the goddess Sulis Minerva. Wow. So that's someone who wrote his own letter, as it were, to the goddess here, and also wrote a similar one up in Uli, presumably hedging his bets to which god or goddess would help him out best. Now, these tablets, they're quite small. They're about the size of a small letter envelope. I mean, not if that, smaller than a postcard. And they have they're actually pewter. It's a mixture of tin and lead. You can call them lead if you like. It's a soft metal. It's grey. And when you scratch into it with a stylus, a pointed writing instrument, you scratch the letters into the lead and the silver underneath, because it's the darker on the outside, shows up as lettering. It's kind of magic lettering, because these letters are written backwards, like in mirror writing. Sometimes in mirror writing, like, so you read it from right to left. Other times in mirror writing, you read from left to right, but the letters are all reversed. Obviously, this is kind of magical, because it means the goddess can read this, but if somebody else by chance sees your letter, they can't easily see what it says. It took a very specialized, highly qualified guy called Roger Tomlin to read these curses over a period of about 2 or 3 years after they were excavated. And some other inscriptions were found. There was what we think of as temple plate. There were dishes and ewers and jugs and plates and bowls and little tiny saucepans that we call paterae in bronze and silver and pewter, and were found thrown into the spring during these excavations back in 1980 and 1981. These pots and pans, as it were all somewhat worn out and damaged, and some had actually been repaired. And one of them had been used, been folded up. It was a flat plate and it had been folded up. And then someone had written one of these requests to the goddess on it and thrown it in. We think, and nearly all of the others had either DSM or DLSM scratched into the metalwork. That's Dea Solis Minerva, mm-hmm. which means this belongs to the goddess Solis Minerva, DSM or DSLM. And we're pretty sure that that means that this is plate that was worn out by being used in sacrifices and special ceremonies in the temple or in the courtyard. And then it was replaced. And of course, we don't have the replacements. They've been long ago recycled. But these early ones were, they seem to be sort of second century date stylistically. So they were worn out and they were thrown into the spring. So they were ceremonially discarded. What was thrown away? They were thrown back to the goddess, if you like, into her spring. So that's quite an interesting insight into, you know, the way things were done. To return to the tablets, what were people asking for? Mostly the return of stolen goods. And if they couldn't get stolen goods back, they wanted dire punishments to be visited on whoever it was who'd stolen their objects. The objects were things like cloaks, dressing gowns, gloves, things that were probably left in the changing rooms. A purse with 3 silver coins, 6 silver coins, quite a lot of money, that's 6 silver coins. You know, you'd be annoyed if it got stolen. So sometimes the person writing the request to the goddess says, I want you to punish whoever it was. If I don't know whether they were free or a slave or a man or woman, or in one case, pagan or Christian, which shows that Christians were around in the late probably 3rd century. The most bloodthirsty one, I suppose, is I think it's the one that mentions Christians, but he says, if this person can't return the goods, I want them to never have children. I want them to be sterile. I want them to die. And another one says, if you find my stolen items, I want you to stuff them up their nose. and all sorts of, you know, dire things, and the internal bleeding and death forever and all this kind of stuff. But some others are rather, I mean, that's kind of interesting insight. People haven't changed when they get angry. Part of the reason that they get angry, I suppose I should say, is that there were no policemen around in this period in Roman Britain. You could ask the local centurion in charge of the region. That's often how it worked. Like a local mayor or something, to investigate. If you had something stolen from your house, that was a civil matter. You had to sue someone. The police wouldn't be the army wouldn't be interested, just the local authorities. If it was stolen from a bathhouse, there was a special law. If something was stolen from a bathhouse, that was a crime. And if you were caught, you could be sentenced to work and to be a slave, to work in the mines, that sort of thing. And so people were saw it as something very, very serious and very angry making, because they couldn't actually get at the person. And one of the other aspects that these tablets have given us is the mix of names and mix of what we think of as ethnicity in Roman Bath. We have lots and lots and lots, hundreds of names on these tablets, because when they're complete, the person who made the request to the goddess usually put his name, her name, on it. But very often they had a shrewd idea who it might have been. And they give a list of names saying, these are the people I think may have done it, or one of these might have done it. And there's this list of names. And some of the names are very Roman, and some are what we recognize as local British or Celtic names. Mm-hmm. And some are kind of crossover names, you know, which kind of mean could have been either. And in one family, there's one famous tablet that says a family, a son, a husband and wife, daughter and son-in-law, son and daughter-in-law, are all standing by the Fons Sulis, the sacred spring of the goddess Sulis. And they've made an oath saying that one of us on this group here has actually is lying. We're pretty sure one of us is lying, but we don't know who. So we've made this oath to the goddess for you to find out who it is who's lying. And the names in one family are a mix of Celtic and Latin. There are three of them that are almost identical, as Docilis, Docis, and Docilinus, that they are actually they're Latinized names, but they also mean something in British language, in Celtic, something like peaceful or calm. And there are other names that are just like Cuno Magalus, which are just Celtic names, even the same family, you know. So by this stage, by, you know, a couple of hundred years probably after the Roman conquest, everybody's sort of mixed up the language and so on.
So the tablets, Peter, they give us insight into the daily lives of these people. I mean, and we can see in some ways how similar these people were to us, and how, you know, petty they were, just as we are.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, as an archaeologist, especially in Bath, you're surrounded by these big structures and baths and engineering works and so on. And we have dug houses and in other parts of the city, both grand and not so grand. You're reminded when you do this, see this sort of thing, that these houses, these monuments, were populated by people not really very different to us. Different aspect, different, you know, beliefs and ideas and ways of doing things, but deep inside, they're the same as us. They're the same people as us. For example, there's a rather sad tombstone that was found in the 18th century, which is now in the Roman Baths Museum. And it's to a little girl who died age, I think it's 4 years, 3 months, 4 days, that actually says to that extent. Basically, it says this tombstone was erected by her loving, grieving parents.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, there's this little girl who died. Children died a lot. I mean, infant mortality in the Roman period and was high. Infectious diseases couldn't be treated. If a child got any of the diseases now that we either vaccinate against or can treat, you likely die unless you were very lucky and fought it off.
So what was the most revealing discovery of the Roman bath during your time in excavation?
Digging in the king's bath, I should say, as a human being, was fascinating because of the wonderful things we were digging up. Lots of coins, fragments of giant crossbows and metalwork and pottery and all sorts of jewellery and everything, things that people had fallen in. They were just interesting to see. But in terms of, and the tablets themselves, of course, told us about those people, lots about those people. As do the tombstones, which are, as is the way of the Roman tombstones, they are generally full of information about the person they're referring to. But I think for me, one of the most important and revealing thing I found out during my time was actually where the Roman town was. Because in the second century, this central area around the monumental baths, the temple, other baths, other buildings, other grand buildings, was enclosed by a bank and a ditch, and later on by a wall, about 24 acres in size, which is very small for a town. And people always looked at this and think, is that really the town? Well, we found very few remains of actual houses inside that enclosure. We think that was the monumental religious enclosure of the spring, the temple, the baths. This is where people came, a bit like you know, a cathedral precinct, or, you know, it's the holy area. And excavations all through the 1990s along the road that runs from the north gate of that enclosure for about a kilometre towards, well, it goes northwards, but it swings around, and it's the road to London. And along that road, we now know that the Romans really built their town. That's where the houses, shops, workshops, houses of all sorts of quality, which then actually some of the rather grander houses went down in over the 100, 200 years, became workshops and that sort of thing. All the way along that kilometre, we haven't dug all of it, of course, but sampling, everywhere we sampled along the road, we found dense occupation on the street front, because that modern road is the Roman road out of town, out of the central area, and also running back towards the river, because the river runs about 100 yards back from this road I've been describing. This area is fairly densely occupied by Roman buildings. Whenever we've looked, we've found Roman buildings. from the first century, from very early period, right up until the end of the Roman period. So it was a very busy part of town. So if you were coming in from London or anywhere from the northeast and north, rather, you would come in along that road, and it would be lined with houses, shops, and so on. And some of it looking rather grand, because two buildings we excavated had a covered portico, a covered walkway over the pavement. So there was the road and there was the pavement, and then the building behind along the pavement. And so you had a covered walkway, a portico, along the road. So how far that extended, we don't know, but probably more than just those two houses. What we've done is in that those excavations over about 10 or 12 years in the 1990s, early noughties, we've kind of redesigned our idea of what Roman Bath, Aquaesulis, was like. Yeah, and also more recent excavations by other organisations have shown that there is even more occupation in Roman building and housing on the other side of the river to this high street, as I call it, this road running out of the centre of the bar from the north of the baths.
So it's given us more of an insight into the daily life and kind of the, you know, humdrum of the normal person in this area.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you were, we can only just, you know, extrapolate from what we know elsewhere, but we know that, for example, some of the people who stayed here, who settled here, were expired military veterans. We know that there was a Roman military presence here in the late first century. We still haven't found a fort or a base, but we have found lots of military items that would have been dropped or lost by soldiers. And also lots, we're pretty sure that the Roman army in that very early period set up their own pottery workshop. Again, we haven't found the pottery workshop, but we found pottery that had failed in the kiln, showing that there was a kiln nearby. The kind of pottery is very specifically what the Roman army used to make for itself or buy if it couldn't make it itself, specific kinds and shapes and fabrics. So if they survived their term of service, especially the troops we call the auxiliaries, there were the legionaries who were normally, the legionaries were the main part of the army, and they were already citizens. If you joined as an auxiliary, you weren't a citizen, a Roman citizen. After 25 years, if you lived that long, you'd get citizenship, and your family will get citizenship, which was a valuable thing to have. And you got a diploma, actually cast in bronze, brought in a paper version as well, but a permanent thing, explaining why and how that you had these rights to citizenship. And we found one of these diplomas in this area, this area of Bath called Walcott, where this high street is, showing that a guy had retired in the early second century. And presumably had lost this many years later when it was no longer of value. And we don't know his name, unfortunately, but we have which cavalry regiment he served in and who the commanding officer was, and this was his sign-off. We have evidence of, in one place, of a probably a pottery kiln, not the one I was talking about earlier, but the army had set up, but we actually found what looks like a kiln, which was set up in the early 4th century, in a building that was built in the second century and had been a rather grand house, but it had fallen into disrepair and been changed around a lot and had a workshop in it. Another excavation of a building, we were able to show that it was a blacksmith's workshop. There's there are a lot of blacksmith's workshops known in Roman Britain because iron was a very basic material, and anything that was made out of metal would be made in a blacksmith's workshop. We've actually found two, one in the fourth, well, both dating to the fourth century, actually. One in this area that I call the town, north of the central area, and one that had been set up in the late fourth century in what seems to have been a very grand, substantial building, not very far from the baths, possibly at a time when the baths and this grand Roman building weren't in use anymore as such, that late on in the Roman period. So we've got blacksmiths working, we've got potters, we've certainly got engineers, builders, we've got slaves doing all sorts of stuff, we've got scribes, we've got, there is the priest of the temple, we know of one of them whose tombstone was recovered, his name was Receptus. He was 75 when he died, and he'd married his slave, which meant that she was freed. We don't know anything much about her except her name, and she set up his tombstone. And we can only imagine her mixed feelings, because when he died, she became a fully free lady. And we don't know how much consent she'd given to being married to this priest as a former slave. But nonetheless, you know, that's the kind of thing you've got. We know that one guy, we dug up two burials near this pottery workshop I was talking about. One was a man in his middle age, obviously very well off. We could tell from his bones what his diet had been in his last years. Extremely meat rich. He had a lot of meat, which kind of implies a sense. And this guy, for other things we can find out from the bones, was born in the Middle East and had come to Britain. He'd been buried in a lead-lined coffin, which again is an expression of wealth. Next to him was buried a young woman. She died in her late 20s, probably. She was buried in a plain wooden coffin. She had no sort of neither of these two burials had goods with them, which suggests they might have been Christian. They're very late Roman, very towards the end of the Roman period, when there certainly were Christians around. And as a rough rule, Christian burials have no goods with them, whereas Roman burials often have, pagan burials often have pottery or other offerings with the individual. And this young woman had broken a leg. It had healed, but badly. She had arthritis from hobbling around on this poorly healed leg and died of some disease, we don't know what, in her late 20s. So there's a contrast of two different kinds of lives, if you like. Poor and rich did live cheek by jowl. If you had a grand house and you had slaves, the slave next lived in the slave quarters, maybe separated by a wall from your rather grand places. If you were just a retired legionary without maybe too much money, you still probably have a slave or two, rather like a Victorian, a 19th century middle-class lawyer might have a cook and a housemaid, but you know, there wouldn't be slaves, obviously, at that point. That's how you would see them. Most of the people visiting the town were literate, because we talked about writing on these tablets. Mm-hmm. They were all obviously serious. They believed seriously in the power of the goddess to help. Otherwise, why come? It's like going to Lourdes today, you know, for help. If you're a Roman Catholic, weren't much point in going if you didn't believe it.
So you are studying, you have access to uncoveries and excavations on individual people, which I think is incredible. It gives you insight into their individual lives and not just kind of allowing us to make broad scale generalizations on the society. You're looking at these individual people, and from that you can gain a more kind of full, rich, deeper picture of this whole city.
That's right. And there'll be more to come, because the Roman Baths Museum have just started a research program, which will involve a PhD student using all the latest techniques of DNA, ancient DNA analysis, molecular studies on the isotopes you find in teeth and bones, which will tell you where people lived before they died, where they were born, what the relationships are, did they suffer from certain diseases, and so on. If you're lucky, you'll be able to tell whether that person had brown hair or blonde hair or blue eyes or brown eyes, where their links are back to their ancestors and origins. That program is just beginning on a collection of about 20 or 30 human individuals' remains, which have been curated in the Roman Baths Museum over the last 20, 30 years. Because unfortunately, lots of burials were discovered in the 18th and 19th centuries. But the human remains were usually either discarded or reburied. Mm. They didn't think there was any particular interest. Well, now we can learn so much. So, but we don't dig that many Roman individuals. In the last 20 years, I think we've excavated about five or six. But some of these other ones have turned up in the store in the Roman Baths Museum. And we also have, and we're concentrating on the Roman ones, but there will be Anglo-Saxon burials and medieval burials. That'd be somewhere down the line to see what we can learn about those individuals. I mean, just from skeletal remains, you can learn about things like TB and VD, you know, venereal disease, injuries, and so on. Just by looking, arthritis, all these sorts of diseases. Oh, and there's a disease which causes pretty major changes to your vertebrae, which is due to eating too much meat and too much fat. Often the case actually with monks from the Middle Ages. But anyway, that's another story. What we don't know about is we don't have a big picture of many people. We have snapshots of individuals. We know in the early period when we have the Roman army and their tombstones, they usually say where they're from, and we have people from who were here and died here because their tombstones here, who came from Switzerland, Northern Italy, possibly Belgium, France, Spain. This is typical of the Roman army, people coming from all over the place. But those individuals usually, well, either they were wounded and they came for rest and recreation or cure and didn't work, or they caught the same diseases that everybody else suffered from and died. It doesn't usually say, it just says they died at age 25 or 30 or 40 or whatever. And this is their career and this is their name and this is what they were. One tombstone shows us that we have a young armourer, a guy who made the armour for his comrades. And his tombstone was paid for by the Guild of Armourers. So, you know, we get these insights into individuals. This is the guy who was probably from Belgium, but he may have been local. There's a reason for that. But the conventional view is he was from what we're now, modern-day Belgium.
It seems like this place, Bath, was somewhat of a destination spot. People came from all around, you know, Europe.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. Apart from the soldiers, we have a sculptor who came from modern-day Chartres, and a lady who came, we don't know anything much about her except she was middle-aged, and her name was Russonia Aventina. She came from Trier, modern Trier in Germany, southern Germany, to the Baths. And again, these people who came from a distance to the Baths died here, presumably came for the cure, and it didn't work. But there's always a possibility that people came to retire here because it was a nice place. You know, we just don't know that. We don't have that information.
I want to kind of round it out, Peter, and kind of ask you to talk a little bit about the decline of the baths. What was that slow, gradual process that eventually kind of decommissioned the structure?
It's an area of mystery to some extent, because we have these ruins that we can look at. We have a very limited amount of archaeology of that late period, layers and structures that belong to that late period. So it's difficult to be sure what was going on. If you put it in the broader framework, well, just to jump ahead, the Roman administration, the Roman army, left Britain in 407. I'll come back to that, to 407 AD. The 4th century, the 300s leading up to that period, after about 320, was actually a period of quite substantial wealth and economic activity and the good times, if you like, in the western part of the British Isles. Buildings were going up, new villas, new houses, new baths. There was a lot of investment in the Roman baths in the early to mid 4th century. The last thing we can actually show that was done to the Roman baths in terms of additions and repairs took place after 340 AD. So they were still doing repairs and things after 340 AD, middle of the 5th century. And that was a period where, you know, nobody living at the time would have had any idea that things were going to go downhill pretty quickly. The Central Empire, from about 380 onwards, started to suffer from all sorts of issues, attacks from barbarians, probably a couple of pretty nasty episodes of the plague we were going through, reducing manpower in the army and in the tax base, if you like. Around about 380s, there was a lot of problem with invading troops and invading barbarians, so you used to call them, people from Central Europe and Northern Europe. Originally, some of them from Central Asia. These are the Vandals and the Goths and the Huns and so on. But that was beaten back, and the empire kind of pretty much established itself. But then there was a series of young, weak emperors and civil war, and things kind of just went downhill, and the ability to control this vast empire from the center started to decline. We don't know what was happening in the Roman baths and in the temple in that last half of the 4th century, except that we know that around about 350, the temple precinct for the last time was cleaned, was swept out, because we find coins of 350s on the paving of the Roman courtyard. They're not cleaned up. And then we find a lot of rubble and dirt and soil accumulating, the sort of stuff you get in an open-air courtyard if nobody's looking after it. After about, as far as we can tell, about 380 or so, people start to repave that courtyard, but very roughly, very crudely, almost like cobbling over the original of this dirt and muck that accumulated over the temple precinct floor. Then that process of dirt and muck accumulating and more cobbling and more layers being made. So people were using this area, wanting to floor it, but it wasn't being maintained in the way it had been before. And then the big thing that happened about 390, the outdoor altar was actually thrown down. We know that because parts of it, recognizably parts of it with carvings of gods and goddesses on, were thrown down and incorporated in one of these pavings. And then around about 400, we find recognizable chunks of the grand buildings around the temple precinct incorporated into the latest pavings, which we can think we can date to around about 430. So from about 380 to 430, you've got the temple precinct being used, being paved, and these pavings have a lot of wear on them. We can see that there are people using them. But they're incorporating bits of the buildings that had stood around the courtyard. So these buildings are now derelict. Again, around about 430, the grand carved pediment, that's the gable above the columns on the front of the temple, 30 feet up in the air, was built, were all thrown down. These are religious carvings, pagan carvings, thrown down, thrown face down, and reused as paving, again, around about 420, 430. And that really does indicate that the temple wasn't in use anymore, that probably was being the area was probably being Christianized, and also that somebody had the authority or the bravado to destroy this pagan settlement, this pagan site with its temples and its outbuildings and its colonnades. They must have, there was no one to stop them. They must have either authority or power to do this, which kind of implies that the whatever organization was running the baths and the temple didn't really exist anymore. It had no influence. But we do find very early 5th century items still being thrown into the king's bath, into the hot spring. And the very latest pavings, these late pavings that incorporate bits of temple and bits of other structures, have wear patterns that lead to the door of the great spring, of the temple, of the king's bath, the sacred spring. So people were still going to the spring and making offerings right up into the 430s. How much longer, we don't know. The evidence archaeologically runs out. And it does pretty much all over. The baths themselves, if the temple was in such a state and it was being, buildings were being knocked down and so on, we can only assume they weren't being looked after, weren't being maintained, weren't being used anymore, sometime maybe around 390s, 400s. But we simply don't know because the archaeology that might have shown us some of that information was removed by the Victorians without record when they cleared the site, when they first discovered it. We did find a little area of archaeological deposit which ran from late Roman into late Saxon, so 400 to 800, 900 AD, in one corner of the baths. We excavated it. And it appears that in around about 400, some parts of these heated rooms I was talking about earlier were smashed down and partly demolished. But we can also show that some other heated rooms and other places weren't knocked down, weren't demolished. So it looks like the buildings were being partially recycled, if you like, partially demolished, but other bits were still standing. Another item that we do know about is that the stone paving around the Great Bath, there's a lot of very substantial stone paving, has wear patterns, very substantial wear, like 6 inches. These are thick slabs of stone, and some of them worn down 5 or 6 inches deep with people walking backwards and forwards. Now, that could never have happened while the baths were in use as baths, because in the baths you weren't barefoot, or you wore straw, sort of espadrille, soft-soled shoes. And people walking on the site now, because if you visit, you can still walk on that paving. They've been doing that for 140 years. There is no wear. People wearing outdoor shoes. What caused these wear patterns? I think it must have been, well, I can show that it was late. It must have been after it ceased being used as a baths. People were using it for something else, and they were wearing outdoor shoes, which at that time almost certainly means sandals or shoes with hobnails, and those hobnails would have worn away the soft bath stone quite quickly and quite easily. And that kind of wear you get when you're wearing outdoor shoes. So there's something going on. So I think what we're looking at is an establishment that ceased to be used as a baths, was being sometime in the late 4th, well into the 5th century. But water is still flowing. The King's Bath, the sacred spring where the water came up. We know that the vaulted brick and concrete and stone roof collapsed into the spring because we found it collapsed when we did the excavations under the water, as it were. Mm-hmm. What happened then was that roof falling into the hot spring raised the water level in the hot spring from the Roman level to about another 4 or 5 feet higher, still contained within that rectangular Roman building that they built in the second century, whose roof had collapsed, but the walls were still there. And those walls turned this rather oddly shaped sacred spring the Romans built into a rectangular bath. And that became the medieval King's Bath. And we know that it was in use in probably the 8th and 9th centuries, which means it must have been used earlier, because we have two references. One just talks about there being a hot bath in baths, which people came to from all over the place. The other saying that there is a bath in the land of the Quichy. The Quichy are the Saxon tribe who took over this area of the Dubunni. There's a bath in the land of the Quichy, which is made of brick and stone, which the current one is. I mean, that medieval reuse of the Roman bath spring is brick and stone, where a man may go to have a bath, and he can have a hot bath or a cold bath as he pleases. Now, we don't know quite what that means, but that's someone writing in the 800s saying there is a bath in Bath, which fits the description. There's a famous poem written by a Saxon poet in the probably 8th century, possibly a bit earlier, called The Ruin, which describes a bath with hot water flowing over its courtyards, but which is in ruin. And it doesn't say that it's bath, but all the description, which is quite detailed, tells you that it must be bath. And it's also the hot flood flowing over the stone courtyards they talk about. So we've got a period when, you know, things are going downhill. We don't know the detail, but we've got fascinating, tantalizing glimpses. I mentioned the date 407. I'll simply say that in terms of the bigger picture, that was when the last Roman armies left Britain. There was no longer a Roman army in Britain in 407. In 410, there is a letter written by the emperor. There's some argument about what it means, but it seems to suggest to the townships all around the empire that you've got to look after yourself now. I'm busy fighting a civil war, basically, and I'm not going to be able to send troops back to you. And it appears from just reading backwards from what we know later, that the Roman local administrative units reorganized themselves as small kingdoms, if you like, with raising their own troops and that sort of thing, so that the bath would have been in the area of the modern town of Cirencester, Carinium Dobonorum. That's the main town of the Dubunni, an area that they probably organized as a defensive unit, as an administrative unit, and presumably the rich people, the landowners and all that thing, club together to try to run the place for a while. And it seems they probably did, because that area that the Dubunni were running, the late Roman, post-Roman Dubunni people were running, became almost completely, exactly, the Saxon kingdom of the Quiche a few hundred or so years later. We don't know the changeover date or period. We don't have that information. So I think there's a certain amount of continuity on a small scale of the administrative unit. And then it's not until, then the 8th century, it becomes part of the fairly powerful kingdom of Mercia, one of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, which later merged to form England. Yeah, in that later period, Bath became quite important because it was on the border of two of these Saxon kingdoms, Wessex in the south and Mercia in the north, that was actually on the borderline. And so it retained a certain amount of importance to the various kings and princelings. From 410 to 700, a lot of it is inference and controlled guesswork and so on, because the archaeology of that period is very difficult to interpret, and there is very little written history.
It's interesting, though, to think about or imagine the bath as a development. It had its own life. You know, we often think of an architectural monument as a stagnant, static piece and living one life. This thing truly had a long lifespan, used by many different people. And it writes the history of not just itself as a building, but also the culture, the society around it. And you know, that's one of the reasons I love to study architecture, because it reveals so much about the people around it and the history through just a building, sticks and bricks and stone. You can find out so much. It reveals a lot about the human condition. Thank you so much, Peter. I really appreciate you joining us. Do you have anything else you'd like to add to the conversation that you feel would be worth discussing?
No, I think the only thing I might say is, anybody watching this and is inspired to visit the city, when you turn up, you might feel that the entrance fee to the museum is rather steep. It's not a cheap experience. But a few years ago, there was a survey, and people queuing up to go in were asked what they thought about the price, and they thought, well, mostly this one was a bit steep, you know, because we're here, we've got to see it, you know. And then they were surveyed when they left, after they'd been through and seen everything, and asked if they thought it was worth it, and 90% said yes.
I can vouch for that. When I went over there, we took a tour in the evening and went in, and then the following morning we actually reserved the bath for ourselves to do filming and walk around and kind of study the place. And it was worth every penny. So I can attest to that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. It's been interesting to talk to you.
Yes. Thanks so much, Peter. I really appreciate it. Really insightful. And I personally learned so much, and I hope people listening also did. So thank you.
Okay.